Hello and welcome to the Reuters Report podcast, where we enrich businesses through business advisors. This podcast is your source for information and news you need for your accounting, bookkeeping, or tax practice, and it is proudly sponsored by Expensify and Rightworks. For more information about both Expensify and Rightworks, please visit woodard.com/podcast. And now your hosts, Joe Woodard and Heather Satterley.
Well, we're back here again for a special edition of the Woodard Podcast. Heather and I, usually when we're together, we talk about things like books we've read, our favorite tweets, and a wide range of other topics. But something very important has happened this week, specifically on April the 23rd. Heather and I are going to be talking about that for the entire episode. If this is a little bit longer episode than you're used to, just hang with us. It is an extremely important topic. Heather, tee it up. What are we talking about today?
Yeah. So all of us in the accounting industry, most of us, I shouldn't say all of us, have signed a non-compete agreement. And we've heard various things about whether it's enforceable or not enforceable. Well, as of Wednesday, the 24th of April, 2024, the FTC has banned non-compete agreements. So of course, it's not that simple. There's a lot of intricacies that we're going to be going through during the podcast today. But that's big news, especially for our industry, because that's been very important, especially in the light of all of the change that we've seen regarding technology, regarding, you know, business models within our industry. This is a big deal. So we need to be watching this closely. So Joe, I'm going to kick it right over to you so we can start digging into some of these details.
Absolutely. Well, let me kind of unpack the ruling for you a little bit. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to unpack it. I'm going to talk about what it is. Heather's going to come back and she's going to cover some of the dissenting comments by the commission, because two voted against, three voted for. So I'm going to talk about where basically what the three who voted for it put into effect, or the commission put into effect. And Heather's going to talk about the dissenting point of view. We're covering both of these, by the way, not as an extension of our own personal opinions about the rule. We will save those toward the end. Right now, this is all empirical information. We're just reporting. Okay, so first, which businesses are impacted? Only those businesses that are within the FTC's U.S. jurisdiction. And there are two kinds of businesses, primary kinds of businesses, that are therefore exempted. One is geographical. If you're an employee and you work in the United Kingdom for a company that is headquartered in the United Kingdom, the FTC has no authority over you. The second exemption is nonprofits are exempted because they are not governed by the FTC. The FTC does not have jurisdiction over a nonprofit organization. But for everybody else, everyone else is included. And there were a lot of comments about, but my industry needs to be excluded. My industry needs to be excluded. And they heard all of those. A couple of them kind of intersected accountancy. One of them was client side businesses, but it was mostly an argument for insurance and real estate. The other one was businesses that require apprenticeship and or that require training as part of their occupation. Interestingly enough, though, accountancy was not specifically mentioned. It was more like plumbers, HVAC workers. So, but if you intersect the two of those together, you can triangulate into why we are not going to be in an exempted category. There's actually no business that ended up being. Heather?
And there was something really interesting when I was reading through it. They had actually said that, and it was one of the commissioners, I don't recall exactly which one it was, had said that some nonprofits actually could be covered by the FTC rule. And that was based on the nature. So basically a not-for-profit that is looking to enrich its members, right, could be affected by this ruling. It was very interesting. So it'll be interesting.
That is interesting. That's an interesting sub comment. So so don't just assume that you are. Do your homework. And by the way, I should have said at the beginning of this, Heather and I are journalists in our role today. We are not lawyers. We're not HR experts. So this gives me a chance to say, don't take anything I've said here as legal advice. Everything I say here, take as reporting. And then what you can do is go to your attorney and say, I heard on the Woodard Report podcast XYZ. I saw a link in their listening guide. I need guidance. So please consult an attorney. So the sale of a business entity, that is an exempted transaction. So this is interesting. If ABC Bookkeeping sells to XYZ Bookkeeping, everyone who worked for ABC Bookkeeping can be bound by non-competes. But the non-competes would be issued by the buying company, XYZ Bookkeeping. The buying company can issue non-competes on all of the employees of the purchased company, so that if they don't hire those people cannot go out and compete against the new owner of the company for some period of time. So there's a logical reason why they would create that exclusion, because why would anybody buy a professional services company specifically if it had no registered marks, no trade secret, they didn't have a national brand, no other assets? Their assets were their people. Well, they could just aggressively then pursue the people of a company cheaper than the acquisition price, and transfer the knowledge from their brains over into their own processes and so forth. So this does protect the whole buy-sell relationship within the business world, especially the small businesses that don't have trademarks, that don't have copyrights, and that can't enforce trade secrets and proprietary information as effectively as can enterprise companies. So then you've got franchises and franchisors. So they are not exempt. A franchise organization still cannot issue non-competes with employees, but a franchisor can issue a non-compete for the entity, its franchisee. So the UPS Store National, or the UPS Corporation, can say, if you're the owner of a UPS store, a local UPS store franchise, I can bind the franchise and its owner to a non-compete. But I cannot bind UPS's headquarters and direct employees, and I cannot bind the franchise's UPS store workers employees. I cannot bind those people by a non-compete, just the franchise owner. And that makes perfect sense too, because I could open up a franchise and then turn around and open up, some other postal service thing after I've gotten all the trade secrets effectively from the franchisor. It would be like buying trade secrets for whatever the buy-in price of the franchise is. Trade secrets, process, and everything for $100,000 is a good deal.
It's so funny too, because if you think about, there's so many ways to get around this, right? So if my employees aren't subject to the non-compete, at what point can I invest money in my employees' new business and not be considered an owner, right? So I think we're going to see a lot of fun little
That's some of the actual dissent language. And you're also more read on the lawsuit that was issued by the Chamber of Commerce, which makes everything we're talking about here potentially moot, depending on what happens with the lawsuit.
Right.
So we'll get into all that in a minute. But absolutely. Now, which workers are impacted? Because this is a big question I'm sure you have, is what about independent contractors or so forth? So the definition of a worker by the FTC for the purposes of this ruling is extremely broad. And I'm actually going to read it to you. So it says which types of, so the worker means, this is the actual definition from the ruling. A worker means a natural person who works or who previously worked, whether paid or unpaid, without regard to the worker's title, the worker's status under any state or federal laws, including, but not limited to, whether the worker is an employee, independent contractor, extern, intern, volunteer, apprentice, or a sole proprietor who provides a service to a person. Now, really watch that last one, bookkeepers. If you're a sole proprietor who provides a service to a person, you're a protected entity or protected worker under this, your client cannot bind you by a non-compete.
That's.
Because you're an independent contractor, sole proprietor. So that's very, very broad, right?
Very broad.
Or society who provides a service to a person. The term worker includes a natural person who works for a franchisee or franchisor, but does not include a franchisee in the context, like we just talked about. So now I want to caveat on something I just said. It's a sole proprietor who works, who provides a service to a person. Right. So yeah, if your client is a person, then like you're doing the books for an individual, right? Then, yes. Or wealth management for an individual, then they can't bind you to a non-compete. If you're a sole proprietor providing a service to a corporation, then the corporation could potentially, again, I'm no lawyer, check with your lawyer, bind that company to a non-compete. As long as the sole proprietor is working for the company, cannot be deemed an independent contractor.
So what I'm hearing, a natural person, my Heather brain, goes immediately to ChatGPT is still subject to non-compete.
It's not a natural person.
It's not a natural person.
Right, so exactly.
So
it's not exempted. And that's a good thing, because that's a strange word, natural person.
Right, it is.
But I also wanted to highlight the state here. Without regard to the worker's title or the worker's status under any other state or federal laws. So is an undocumented migrant, well, you can't employ them anyway, but someone on a green card would be protected by this, right? But an undocumented worker is unhirable anyway, though I don't know all of HR law to know that is a definitive statement. So, but if and under any conditions or under any states, an undocumented worker could be allowed to work legally, because I'm not an HR expert. They would become a worker. They would therefore be protected by this, because it's without regard to their status under federal or state law. So now there is a kind of worker, though, that is exempted. Exempted meaning the non-competes apply, and that is a senior executive, right? So I'm going to get very real with this. You know, I have four senior executives, right? So in my company, there are four people who are exempted. And those people, in order to qualify as a senior executive, you have to have a total compensation of at least $151,164 in either the current or preceding year, annualized. All right. So then the second one is a both and. The second is the worker must be in a policymaking position. So there are four people out of the 23 people at Woodard who fit that bill, and not including me. But see, I own the company, so I'm not going to have a non-compete against myself. So there are four people with whom I can still have binding non-competes. And then the other 19 people, those non-competes, by the basis of this ruling, have been nullified. So we're going to get to what I have to do with those other 19 people in a minute, but let's get to the effective date. This ban will take effect 120 days after the final rule is published in the Federal Register. We don't know exactly when that's going to be, because the published date hasn't happened yet. So if you read the ruling, they're just brackets that say insert date here, right? In the present form of the ruling. And then they will insert the date when we know. But it's anticipated to be late August or early September at the earliest. The legal challenges, which are already in play, may either delay that date or otherwise restrain the scope of this on that date. So you need to definitely stay informed. But as of right now, the ruling is in place in full, as I described. And as of right now, you can expect it to go into effect late August or early September. So now you might say, if you're a business owner in here, and I know a lot of our listeners own bookkeeping practices and accounting firms. So you might say, well, then am I just completely out there in the wind? How am I protected? And we can create a scenario where maybe you hire somebody from a trade school, you teach them everything they need to know, you expose them to all of your processes and your knowledge, and you mentor them, and you steer them, and you guide them. You teach them everything about the occupation. And then 2 years in, when they become maximum profit, generating maximum levels of profits for you, and you start to get the return on your investment, they go and start another competing bookkeeping company. And though they can't take your proprietary information, they can't take the exact workflows with them, though they can't take your trade secrets technically, and though they definitely can't take your brand, right? Whether it's a registered mark with the United States Patent Office or not, and Trademark Office or not, they can't go and name it the same thing as you. They can't have McDonald's and McDowell's, you want to use that from the Coming to America. There are things that you can still restrict them around, but they are permitted to just use you as the learning vehicle to go start a competing company. But there are protections. I already mentioned a couple. Trade secrets and proprietary information they can't bring with them. The knowledge that you gave them, where they could use that knowledge to go out and recreate or reverse engineer similar trade secrets, similar proprietary information out of their existent knowledge from scratch, that is allowed. So you're still empowering them, but with a caveat, they can't just go and become basically effectively a franchise of your organization without paying you royalties. There's a non-solicitation agreement that's not impacted by this. It's specifically mentioned as excluded. Mm-hmm. And the non-solicitation could be of your coworkers and also of your clients. So I can't go start this other bookkeeping company and then solicit my previous coworkers, or even while I'm in the employ, my fellow coworkers, to go launch it. And I can't then reach out to all my clients who were at the other firm and solicit them to come to my firm. Now, they could come over there because they wish to, but I can't solicit them in any way, shape, or form, individually, specifically targeting them. Now, this is the interesting one with non-solicitation, though, is clients and vendors have nothing to do with this ruling. So the relationship, I have Woodard Consulting Group. Woodard Consulting Group provides consulting to accounting firms. Woodard Consulting Group can have a relationship with its clients that has nothing to do with my employees or those clients' employees. So I can tell a client that they are restricted from working with one of my employees or former employees for whatever we agree that restriction period is. They can't solicit them, and they are restricted from working with them for a period of X months or years. That's between me and the firms that are my clients, me and the client. So here, this accounting firms, this is really important, but again, please call your lawyer. My lay interpretation of this is your employee can go out and do whatever they want here. They can start a new firm. And if your clients reach out to them and say, I'd rather work with your new firm now, that is permitted. They could accept that client. However, you can restrict the client from doing so. You can't restrict the employee, but you can restrict the client. But please check with your attorney on what I just said. Present that to her or to him and have them say whether or not that is true. Okay. Then there's another kind of agreement called a TRAP, a training repayment agreement provision. So you could put employees, like I just described, into a training repayment agreement provision that says for a period of time, you are going to work with the company for that minimum period, or there'll be some other kind of financial arrangement with us, given the fact that I have trained you and or apprenticed you in how to do the job, which is similar to or overlaps with another one, time-bound employment agreements. They're also not restricted. So I can tell somebody that they have to work with me, or that there are other kinds of restrictions in their work for me while they're actively an employee for a period of time. Non-disclosures are still very much allowed. All of those things you can still use. However, even though the commission says these exact words, that patent law can be used together with other tools, including NDAs, fixed term agreement contracts, to protect legitimate investments and intellectual property and worker human capital investment. And therefore, these tools taken together are viable alternatives to non-competes. That was a quote from the ruling. You cannot use them in a way that effectively becomes a non-compete, which is an interesting way to phrase it. So they're viable alternatives, but they can't become replacements for. And their definition of a non-compete is something that restricts the livelihood of another person if they were to leave your company, or penalizes them for leaving your company. As long as it doesn't do those two things, materially, holistically restricts their livelihood, not diminishes their income. You can't stop somebody from creating this other bookkeeping company, but there are still protections in place. And then the last thing I want to say is about notification requirements, and then we'll get into some of the dissenting views. You are not required to issue new employee agreements or new independent contractor agreements. Anybody who is currently bound by a non-compete, where you are the issuer of the contract, you can leave those contracts in place. But as of the effective date of this ruling, which is sometime in October or September, those non-compete agreements are nullified as of the effective date. So that's key. That's going to take a massive amount of paperwork off the plates of Business America. But you do have to notify your employees that they are no longer bound. And I assume, because it's a little unclear, that the notification deadline is the effective date of the ruling. So you've got a little bit of a runway here. Again, check with your attorney. And it's interesting, the way that you notify them is specifically detailed, right? So you can't use something like Microsoft Teams or Slack, but what you can use very specifically is email to either their personal or corporate email address if they're a current employee, mail to their home address. That's also permitted. Read through. And also there's a safe harbor language. If you're like, Joe, I can't keep up with all this. I'm trying to run a business. How do I know that I've checked all the boxes, that I've told the employee everything I'm required by law to tell them or the contractor? Then there is a safe harbor language. It will be everywhere very soon. It's buried deep in the 570-page ruling. We will place it on our listener guide, water.com/podcast, so you can get to it quickly. Let's provide some sort of a dynamic link if we can, so that if it changes, we're not chasing our tail over here. And then, but you can use this, just insert your company name and your employee name into right. it. And as long as you use that language, you have complied. Okay. That was a lot to unpack. I'm sure that people have lots of questions. I encourage you to read the 570-page document, as Heather and I have had to do over the last couple of days. It's actually not that bad a reading. And then of course, consult with your attorney. Now, let's talk about comments made by people who were opposing the ruling to the commission, dissenting points of view, and the lawsuit by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Yes. So, there was the original version of this was released back in January of 2024. And so they received over 20,000 comments on this, potential ruling that has now passed. So, one of the opposing comments was, capital investments, right? So lots of comments about, capital investments are going to be negatively impacted by this ruling because people have invested a lot of money in protecting their intellectual property, their processes, and their brand. And now they're going to lose that investment. So that's going to have a negative impact on...
Can I say though, the smallest of the small businesses are negatively impacted. So if you take a business that's been at it long as I have copyrights, mm-hmm. I have registered marks, and I have documented all of my trade secrets and my proprietary information. So I'm more protected than the business that is earlier than I am in the life cycle.
Right.
Yes. And that's one of my problems with this is that though this ruling creates a mobility of a workforce, it penalizes the people that use the ruling to go start a new business, because now businesses of my size and larger have an unfair competitive advantage with capital investments, because I can enforce trade secrets and I have an attorney on retainer. They don't have either of those two things.
Right. They don't.
Right. Yeah. And that should be a big argument for those that are advocates of the very small business.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think, you know, I think with the smaller businesses, you know, especially those small entrepreneurs, right, they see that opportunity. And so they are more at risk from the big companies kind of swooping in and taking their IP. So I see where they're going, but definitely agree with, you know, what you said, that the bigger companies have, you know, more advantage as far as protecting.
It would have been
already.
Simple, Heather. They just would have listened to the SBA. And if they would have put an exemption status on businesses under a certain number of employees or under a certain size mm-hmm. in revenue,
right?
To me, that was the most logical argument of any of the people who made arguments about exemptions, and every industry tried to make their argument, but they should have listened to the SBA on that one. You know, I think businesses under a million, at least under three employees or three or under employees, they need to have protections from the people that could basically then sue them out of business, you know, to bully them away from the free market that this whole ruling is designed to protect.
Well, they definitely, I mean, the whole ruling is very broad. It is very broad. And, you know, I think you and I both talked about, you know, there's a reason for that, because this is definitely, there's already been a lawsuit filed, right? And that this is definitely not the first, right? So I think that there's holes, you know, big holes that they could have, you know, plugged, but I think it's a work in progress. The bigger issue, and I'm just going to talk about the big giant elephant.
Can I interpret what I think you're saying there? Are you saying that you think maybe they went very strong on the ruling, anticipating that the lawsuits would pull them back a little bit? Is that part of the game? That's very insightful. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, with the dissents that happened. So we know that this ruling was passed with, you know, basically three people voted for it, three people voted against it. The big overwhelming thing, there are two people voted against it. And the two people that voted against it, what they said was that this is unconstitutional, that the FTC is an administrative body, and that they do not have the authority to make this type of ruling, and it's unconstitutional. That basically, they are not elected officials. Congress actually had put forth a bill in 2021 that was defeated, that basically was exactly what they just passed. And so what they're saying is, you know, this should not have been passed. They don't have the authority to pass it. And that, you know, that you know, an administrative entity within the government does not have the authority to enforce, to pass it or enforce it. So it's unenforceable. So that was the big kind of takeaway from those dissents, right?
So it could be that the lawsuits could modify it, mm-hmm. which is kind of the point you just made before, is go strong in case we get modified. But based on what you just said, with the lack of precedent, and maybe the argument of an overreach here, however high this goes up, probably to the Supreme Court, that could be deemed unconstitutional. It could be handed back to Congress to figure this out.
That's exactly right. And yeah, that's exactly right. So, you
and
know,
we do what, have a Supreme Court right now that leans right.
Yes.
And not making a political statement about the right or wrong of lean right, because we're apolitically, or what, are just stating a fact. And the other fact is that the conservative or more right perspective is typically more pro-business owner and employer. And both of those things are general statements, and both of them don't represent my point of view, but it's just a statement. So if it gets to the Supreme Court, then the Supreme Court is, you know, is tipped that way. This will all be very fun to watch.
It is going to be very interesting. And, you know, really what they were saying, talking about the lawsuit that was filed the same day by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, what they're saying is they definitely talked about how the FTC is not authorized to pass a ruling like this, and they can't, and they don't have the ability to enforce it. You know, they also, you know, talked about, you know, that they have, you know, that there's basically, it goes against the Fifth Amendment, and that they don't have the ability to do this. So, and mm-hmm. also them basically negating all of these non-compete agreements that already exist is way outside. I mean, they're throwing out, you know, settled court cases, right, that have happened for over 100, right, yes. over 100, you know, over 100 years. So, you know, that's really what it comes down to, is that they're, they're going to go after banks, basically throwing the entire thing out.
That's going to be their first thing, is let's throw this whole thing out.
Let's just not even like try and go through how do we change this. Let's just get rid of the whole thing because it's unconstitutional.
Yeah. And so, if they can't win on those grounds, then they'll come back for modification. That, of course, nobody can see the future. But that seems logical. As a court. Right. Plus, it also, based on what you're telling me from the lawsuit, which I've not read, it seems to be the way they're going is complete. To completely overrule the ruling. Let's not deal with modification until we have to.
Oh, that's like, no, they, it, yeah. It's said in the lawsuit, throw it out. Like throw it out. The first statement is this should just be thrown out. Mm-hmm. So, that's what they're going for. We'll have to wait and see. Right. We just had a similar thing happening with the BOI, right. Where they're fighting that now. So we'll have to wait and see what's going to happen. But I think that for now, Joe, what do you think? What do you think businesses should do?
Well, for now, first, you need to go ahead and talk to your lawyer, right? And you need to understand what your responsibilities are here. And you need to prepare to adhere to this ruling until you hear from your attorney otherwise. Okay. And so that's the first advice I would give to everybody, is be compliant. Be prepared to be compliant in the event that this actually goes into effect in August or September. I have already emailed my attorney. My attorney said that he has received hundreds of emails this week and that he'll be providing general guidance and then specific guidance to his clients over the next 2 months. So just keep in mind, your attorney has probably never been busier in their life. It would be likened to Congress making a change to the tax code in February, which they did back in 2013. So you remember how that was so crazy. This is what the attorneys are going through now. So be patient with your attorney. And watch for more specific guidance to come from the legal community, mm-hmm. And from legal review journals and more official definitive sources too. And then I would encourage you to read those. Now, because opinions will be abounding. So now that I've given the more specific imperial advice, I'm going to let opinions abound. Heather, let's share our opinions on this, okay? My opinion on this ruling is that the spirit of it is noble. That I love entrepreneurialism. I do not like the oppression of any people group by any other people group. And anybody that's using non-competes to create oppressive, restrictive, or penalizing realities on a worker should be governed away from doing that. I get why there needs to be an address to this. I wish Congress had done it when Congress had it, because then it would have been done by our representative government. It would have had more voices in the room, and it would have been our entire legislative branch checked and balanced by our executive branch and our judicial branch, creating a reality for the business world of America. That seems a lot more democratic than what happened with the FTC. So the spirit behind this, I agree with. I also do not think the FTC should have this kind of power. And I think that if this does stand, the FTC will be emboldened and will only exercise more and more and more rogue power, to where five people in the United States of America who we did not elect directly are affecting the economy of every American in America. That's too much power. They're not a fourth branch of government. And more importantly than that, They are not the government. Because even if we were to say the FTC becomes the fourth branch of government, at least they could be checked by the other three. But there's nobody checking these five people except these five people. So the commission has way too much, far broad reaching power here. And they need it needs to be handed back to our representative government. So I'm going to stop because that was a big loaded statement. Do you have something to comment
on
that?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the two, you know, the two commissioners that dissented. That's exactly what they said. They said the power doesn't belong here. This really belongs with the people. And we've taken it away from
them. Even the commission said that about themselves.
They even, two of them, that's exactly what they said. You know, they also said that, you know, it's taking power away from the states, right? So it's now becoming a federal ruling, which now-
Can I address that? Because they actually put a bubble around the states. If you read there was a clause there that, like Hawaii, for example, Hawaii is more restrictive than this ruling. So I'm not sure, but I think Colorado is as well. But I know Hawaii is because they were specifically mentioned in the ruling. So what they're saying is if your state policies are at this level of restriction or greater or more restrictive, you can be more restrictive than this. But you can't be less restrictive than this. So yes, states' rights are an issue in this. I didn't mean to neutralize the issue in it.
Right.
Georgia should be able to govern Georgian businesses. There's an argument for that, you know, up to a point, because we are still the United States, right? So this tension between state governance and U.S. governance, you can say that it's disempowered the state's authority over its own corporations. However, the counter argument to that in the report was no state is an island unto itself, especially in this virtual world. I mean, you're my employee legally. I call you my team member functionally. You're a senior executive at Woodard. So, but you don't live in Georgia. You live in Rhode Island, you know, which I have to always remind myself as a state. It's so little. But the point is they make a good point there. So we have to create some sort of a consistency across this entire virtual world that we live in, right? Now, but if Georgia wants to be more restrictive than the ruling they're allowed to be, so that's an interesting caveat.
Yeah.
What do you think, Heather, what's your opinion on all of this beyond what we've already talked about?
So my opinion on it is, I mean, non-competes are tough to enforce anyway, right? They've been tough to enforce anyway. So I feel like there's that, right? I think that this conversation needed to be had, and I think that this is going to, you know, push it out. I personally think that it will be overruled. It will be thrown out as unconstitutional. As far as my personal opinions on whether or not, you know, it should be enforceable, I think that the other vehicles that we talked about, the NDAs, I think that those, you know, the NDAs,
the non-solicitation,
things
traps.
Like that. I think that is sufficient. So my personal opinion is that, you know, we don't need this.
You know, I tend to agree with you because of the statement I just made, say, for example, for Woodard Consulting Group. My employees are free to do whatever they want, but I can restrain my clients through the master services agreement I issue between me and the clients from engaging with my former employees. And they can't take my proprietary information, my trade secrets, my marks, and so forth with them. So it is the perfect scenario. I'm protected as a business owner and the employee is protected to go out and become their own entrepreneur in the same category. But then you need to get with your attorney, listeners, because if you don't issue contracts with your clients, if you just have it passes peer review tax engagement letter, then you are not protected by everything I just said. So if there's no other takeaway than you receive from this whole episode, you need to have client contracts that only reference your employees and restrain your clients from what they do with your employees and former employees and independent contractors and agents and assigns and all that legal speak. But those are not impacted or not governed by this ruling. And then you're right. Then the non-compete becomes unnecessary. Just flip where you're trying to regulate behaviors, business owners, from the employees
to
the clients or customers, from the employees to the vendors, true vendors, not independent contractors.
Right, right.
And you will stay protected.
I agree with that. And I agree with you, Joe, that the spirit of this is in the right place, right? It is to protect the workers. It is to protect innovation and the ability to go out and, you know, be entrepreneurial. But, you know, we need to think it through a little bit further, and it needs to be the voice of the people, right?
It needs to be a democratic government. That's the last time I checked. Government. It's a representative government.
Exactly.
Democratically elected. And that's the last time I checked, that's still our system.
Yeah. So if I had a crystal ball, I would predict that this will probably not stand.
All right. So I'm going to say something about Woodard, and then you've got something to say from Brad Smith, not into a Brad Smith, Microsoft Brad Smith.
Yeah.
Let's see how they line up. So Woodard has had non-competes in its employee agreements for many, many years, decades. And I have never in the history of Woodard ever enforced them. Right. So they're in there because my attorney told me I was supposed to stick them in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to my attorney, which is smart advice. But it is up to me on how I choose to manage human relationships and how I tend to manage my business. And I can waive whatever I want to waive. So in the history of Woodard, I have had people start companies that directly compete with me in the same segment, like Fishbowl Consulting. And I have had people leave my company to go work for companies that they met while they were in my employee. And even though all of those things are restrained by their employment agreement, I still winced and I permitted it, because it is my position that as long as I'm not placing my business in an acute and direct risk, because the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one, I'm not going to put 23 employees and their livelihoods at risk over the needs of one person if that one person's acting unethically. No way.
Mm-hmm.
But if the person is just being entrepreneurial or trying to advance their career, I've got more important things to do than control the behaviors of others. If I can still protect my company, my family, and my employees in that process, I wish them well. Go be entrepreneurial. Now, what does Brad Smith say about Microsoft?
So Brad Smith tweeted out that Microsoft believes that American innovation thrives when people have the freedom to pursue the career path that they feel best aligns with their passion and skills. And they announced in 2022 that they would no longer enforce non-compete clauses for all but its most senior employees in the United States. So basically, it's following this. It was following this before it actually got passed. So
that's pretty much lines up with Woodard's position on it.
And to
agree with Brad Smith here, I would be a little bit more sensitive to the impact on my other 23 employees if a senior executive left and started a competing brand. I was starting to think about, okay, what about my family? What about these other 22 employees? I would have to be a little bit more protective, right? So right. It makes perfect sense. But if somebody leaves and they didn't have policy making authority within my company, I did not present them as part of the Woodard's leadership brand, it's a hard case to say they're really going to hurt my family or the other 22 employees by starting a little shop someplace.
Yeah,
that's a hard argument to make.
And I agree. I mean, most non-competes in my experience and from the articles that I've read, don't typically get enforced unless it's by a very large company. So it costs money to enforce. Exactly. So, that's exactly right.
In my case, I was doing it because of my philosophy of life, but other people have to do it because of the legal costs. But this brings us back full circle to who are we trying to protect here? And if we're trying to protect the worker, this does. If we're trying to foster entrepreneurialism, which was it stated specifically in the economic justification of the ruling that even it's so funny because they were saying there's no empirical evidence of what this ruling is going to do in the negative. Therefore, mm-hmm. they dismissed all opposing comments because of a lack of imperial data. They said in the ruling that they are expecting X number of new jobs and X number of billions of dollars to be poured into. Where's the empirical evidence? If you're going to create an, you don't have empirical evidence either in a ruling that's never taken effect. So they're using empirical evidence to create an economic justification, and the lack of empirical evidence to say the negative comments are excluded. That's contrary. That's that's hypocritical. It's double standard. So, but what they're saying is the entrepreneurialism is one of those economic justifications. And my argument is coming back to what I said before is the people that are least protected by this are the ones that can't afford attorneys, who can't afford to draft up client agreements and vendor agreements, who can't draft up all of the other kinds of restrictive covenants with employees that are still permitted. And if they had them, cannot afford to pay an attorney to enforce them. Those are the people who are least protected by this. Those are the people that are most vulnerable to this. And unfortunately, what this does is it creates power on the established businesses, and especially the Fortune 5000, against those that aren't empowered in that way. Big business just won today.
But, you know, I wonder, Joe, if, you know, were they getting non-competes anyway? Were these entrepreneurs actually putting non-competes in place? And were they, even if they had done that, because you're saying, you know, that what you're saying is that they wouldn't have had the funds or the wherewithal to actually do that. And would they be able to enforce it because of that cost?
Well, that's my whole point is only people that can enforce it are the larger businesses, the established businesses. And I am barely at that precipice, you know, so before I reached this stage of my business evolution, I couldn't have afforded to litigate around non-solicitations and around master services agreement language. I could write it, but you know, once I got to be a business of about say $1 million in sales or so, I could afford to have an attorney to write it. Once I get to be a business of about $5 million or so, I can pay an attorney to litigate it. But the whole point of this was it fosters entrepreneurialism. Well, great. So somebody else is going to go out there and hang a shingle. Somebody else is going to start a business and they don't have their first million yet. And they need to hire people to get there. And they don't have the funds to bring in an attorney. Now there's LegalZoom and all these other things. I get it. So let's just say they could use LegalZoom or some cheap kinds of ways to get the agreements in place. I still argue they can't afford to enforce them.
They cannot.
Until they reach about $5 million in sales and until they reach about 20 employees, because it costs a six-figure amount of money to enforce one of these things in a court of law, even if you go to mediation.
So non-compete is a deterrence, right? It's a deterrence, and that's the whole premise of why they did this. It's a deterrence to say, I'm not going to have that entrepreneurial spirit because I am under a non-compete. Therefore, I know the chances of me going out and doing that, well, it's illegal, right? Because I have this.
The locks are for the honest thieves, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, so we're removing this. What this does is remove the deterrence to go out. So are you basically saying that by eliminating this, you're setting these entrepreneurs up for failure?
For failure.
So basically,
because they can still create the other restrictive agreements that replace the purpose of the non-compete without becoming a non-compete, right?
Right.
They serve as a way of managing controls as long as they don't effectively become a non-compete. The ruling was very specific about
that.
So, and I'm going to correct something I say about not being able to afford to create them. I forgot that there are affordable systems like LegalZoom. So they can affordably go out and get the documents. They may not be as airtight as if they could afford an attorney, but they can get to the documents. They can't enforce the documents. And people pick up on that. You know, that
they do.
Can you really afford, are you really going to spend the hundreds of thousands of dollars to litigate against me? Do you really have that kind of money? So the only people who it's argued were ever protected by any of these kinds of agreements are those who can afford to litigate them. So
I agree.
What they need to do is they need to create more protections for businesses under 5 million in sales and more protections for businesses under 25 or 20 employees. That's really what if the FTC were going to do anything, let's protect those people. And this does nothing to protect them.
My optimist outlook on life says to me that by removing this, you are going to have more people that are willing to take that risk, right? And you could have, and hopefully would have, businesses that will exist because this no longer applies to them, and be very successful and build the economy and build jobs, which is the whole reason in yes. you know, in their justification.
And my pragmatist view says those people are the first deer to come to the stream with the hunter aimed at them. They're going to stir up innovation. They're going to find qualified people. They're going to train qualified people. So the ones that can afford to enforce all of their legal requirements are going to use them as a pool, a farm team, to go solicit their employees and to steal their ideas. And that's what the FTC has done to Small Business America today.
It's going to be a ride, Joe. We'll see.
But let's see what happens. So hopefully, folks, you've enjoyed this episode. It's very different than what we normally do. I want to say again, if you've tuned in late to the episode, we are not HR consultants or advisors. We are not lawyers. We have reported on this from our lay understanding of having absorbed all 570 pages each over the last couple of days. It's been a fun couple of days. If you take nothing else away from this podcast, it's go call your lawyer. All right. Heather, anything to send us home?
And stay on, you know, keep following the Woodard Report, because we are going to have updates to this issue of what's going on. And you'll know. You'll be first to know.
So we're going to have an article about this. We're going to have updating articles about this. And there's a listener's guide for this whole episode.
Yes.
With links to all of the actual rulings and other resources at woodard.com/podcast. All right, Heather, it's been great doing this with you, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, please visit woodard.com/podcast.